Hello, I'm Katie.
And I'm Leslie.
And we're all booked.
Welcome to Sterling Municipal Library's podcast, where we talk to you about books we'd like to recommend.
And in this week's episode, we have all the guests. Like, seriously.
Every guest.
All of them.
Yeah.
And some of it is because we, as people that deal in information, felt like it was really important to take some time and talk about anti-racist resources, especially books. So many of those books are completely sold out right now. We do have a number in our collection, and we've ordered a bunch more. But because there is such a flood of books and articles and resources and recommended things to check out, we wanted to give you guys a highlight of some that we thought were particularly good and worth discussing.
Yes, and instead of just giving you a list with a summary, we did this so you could hear from our perspective and from the perspective of other librarians why these books are important, what change they made in the people who read them. So we kind of formatted this in a learning to doing way, in that the first books are going to be books that will teach you about history, teach you about the foundations of our society and how that can be explicitly and implicitly racist. And then going on to current topics, why they're important to talk about, and kind of answering some of the questions that you might have but be afraid to ask, and then how to fix all of the terrible things that are happening in our society with your own two hands.
Exactly. And this is our longest episode to date, but we felt like this topic was so important that we wanted to take extra time to make sure that we put together something that was very comprehensive.
And to make sure that we're speaking to all age levels and all reading levels. So throughout this podcast, there are books that range from children's books all the way to those big, heavy adult nonfiction books that really teach you every single aspect of a subject. Because we wanted to make sure that anyone who comes to this podcast can leave with something to read, even if it's to give to someone else in their family. You know, there's a lot of options.
Enter this podcast with an open mind. And hopefully we can all do better.
Yes, definitely. Chasley, our children's librarian, is here to recommend a kid's book for us.
My first recommendation for you is a book called Not My Idea, A Book About Whiteness by Anastasia Higginbotham. This is a very blunt, straightforward book about how white people have a history of violence towards brown and black people. It's about a little white girl and her family doesn't want to talk about race or about the tragedies on the news, so she goes in search of answers herself. It's very easy to understand, so it's great for young children, but also has a lot more resources and details in the back, so I would recommend it as just a starter book for all ages.
Our teen librarian, who's also our co-host, is bringing a book and a short story. The book is stamped, but you're talking about the teen edition.
I am talking about the remixed version written by Jason Reynolds. The original is called Stamped from the Beginning. It's by Professor Ibram X. Kendi. Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You is the teen version. And the reason I like this book, it's very clearly a history book, but not a history book. He does go through the history of racism in America. He shows you how it was founded, why it's such an intertwined part of our society. But that's not the important part. The important part is that he's telling you this foundation so you know how to dismantle it. You know why people are so stuck on not changing it, because it gives a lot of people in power this ability to continue taking advantage of people who are struggling. And he also goes through the different kinds of people in the original, like, 1800s segregation abolitionist movement. He talks about segregationists, which everyone know. They wanted to keep black people and white people apart in society. And originally, they just wanted to ship all of the ex-slaves back to Africa, despite the fact that none of them had ever seen Africa. Yes, and Africa probably had something to say about that, too. Then they had abolitionists, and he actually goes out and says, abolitionists wanted black people to have rights, but on the terms of white people. They wanted them to be like white people. They wanted their culture to change to white culture. They didn't want them to be themselves. They wanted them to be accepted in society on the idea that they would just adopt everything that white people do and just be like white people. And then they have anti-racists, people who are like, hey, black people are people and we should just let them be people and not expect them to change how they act or how they speak or the things that they like just because we want to feel more comfortable around them. And that's a really important line because I think a lot of people are like, abolitionists are great. They're so nice. And he's actually like, no, a lot of them owned slaves. A lot of them were racist. Like, they were like, oh, I mean, you know, I have a black friend. So, yeah, like, that kind of, like, they had good intentions, but very bad, like, follow through, I think. And the reason he gives you this information is in his quote, if we understand how the tree works, how the trunk and roots are where the power lies, and how gravity is on our side, we can attack it, each of us, with small axes and change the face of the forest. So the idea is that he's giving you, like, a map of how trees work, trees being institutional racism, so you will know what are the important parts to break down first. So you don't try to, like, chop the limbs off the top of the tree and go, I fixed it, the tree is gone. So you can actually attack the trunk with a lot of other people. And the idea is that your voice and your vote are the axe. Like, that is the ability that you have to change the forest. So it's a really good book. It's very conversational, and that's really important for me. I think it's imperative when you're talking about heavy topics to offer a variety of options for readers of all ages, but also all, like, reading levels and interest levels, because once you read this book, there's a list of further reading in the back. So if you really want to, you can expand upon what you've already learned, but you're not going face-to-face with a 600-page academic nonfiction book, which can be really intimidating. Chasley is back again with another great children's book.
I'd like to recommend The Undefeated by Kwame Alexander and Kadir Nelson. They're two of the biggest names in children's literature today for good reason. It's a story about Black excellence and struggle, and at the end there are short biographies of all the historical figures illustrated in the book, which makes it a great conversation starter for kids of all ages. It is a beautiful book, and I recommend it for absolutely everyone. So if you are a grown-up who can appreciate the gorgeousness of a truly well-done picture book, I recommend that one for you too. It's called The Undefeated by Kwame Alexander and Kadir Nelson.
Erlene, one of our managing librarians, is here with an adult title.
White Rage by Carol Anderson, and she's an academic professor at Emory University for African American Studies. She focuses on public policy, race, justice, and equality. And her book is rather disturbing because it breaks down the whole entire history and discusses Reconstruction, Jim Crow, and the prevention of allowing emancipated Blacks to gain civil rights, political rights, safety, economic independence, independence on a whole, and just gaining a voice. So her particular viewpoint is real hard-hitting, in your face, and it can be very uncomfortable even for me being a woman of color reading it, because she's not really holding back, and it just breaks everything down on a very economic level. So if you think that way, you'll understand it, and it's not pulling to your heartstrings or emotions. It's all about, this is what happened, I'm breaking it down for you. There's no other way to deny it.
One more fantastic book recommendation from Erlene.
I Am Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made of Whiteness by Austin Channon Brown. She's a media producer and speaker and author. Her book gives a very detailed account on how actions fall short with our words. The interesting thing about what I'm presenting today are all three women authors. And I think their perspective on race relations and inequality is a little bit different than hearing a male's voice. But I really want to present that. So with Austin Channon Brown, she's a producer, a journalist, a speaker, and her book tackles schools, churches, universities, and their claim to have diversity, which actually isn't really true. It's forced, or it was filling a quota, and you still felt very separated when you're in these environments, and with churches using the Bible or faith as a stage, but also feeling very separated in your churches. Even now, you have churches that are either predominantly white or Black or Hispanic, and very few have that unified feeling, or people using religion as a way of defending or making people of color use grace to forgive so much. And just the whole history behind Christianity being used as a tool. She goes over that in her book. She details how the world has been built on total whiteness, how white middle class has been participating in the raising of racial hostility, and something that we do not want to acknowledge. And I would say to everyone who's listening to the book reviews to have an open mind and try to not think of things defensively, but be very open when you're listening to or reading the books.
And now we actually have a middle grade book from Chasley.
I have a longer book recommendation for bigger kids up onto tweens, Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson. It's historical. It's this beautiful novel in verse, which can be a big help to reluctant readers. It won everything the year it came out. Newbery Honor, Coretta Scott King Award, National Book Award, and for good reason. The blurb says that it's about her childhood as an African-American in the 1960s and 1970s living with the remnants of Jim Crow, and about the character's growing awareness of the civil rights movement. That really makes it sound way more dry than it is. It's a fascinating and just delightful book. The main character is it's a character that anybody will be able to identify with and absolutely adore.
Toni Morrison has only written two short stories that were published in her lifetime, and one of them is called Recessatif, and it's actually an experiment that she did. She wrote this entire story about two girls who meet in an orphanage, and then they meet a few times throughout their life over and over again, but they're never really like friends long term. They just had this foundational moment together. And the idea of this is that she never actually explains which one is white and which one is black. So throughout the story, your perspective, and mine did, changes back and forth as you see different interactions between them. Like at first I thought I had my ideas about which is which was which, but hilariously, the reading I was listening to by LeVar Burton on his podcast, LeVar Burton Reads, at the end I realized he had the exact different, like, ideas. So it's very interesting. It really points out, like, your biases, everyone's biases, about, like, what you associate with different races, with different cultures, and, like, the lines that you draw in your head before you even hear any, like, description. And the reason that you should listen to it instead of read it is because LeVar Burton is one of the best readers I have ever come across, and for people of a certain age, it'll give you that full reading rainbow nostalgia. He also really engages with the listener. He asks questions, he tells, like, his perspective about it, and then provides you background about the author and the story that makes you really understand it better. And it's kind of like being in a nice book club. Like, he really shares his opinion with you and then asks you questions to further delve into your own opinion to help you shape it. So great. Fantastic. It's under an hour and a half, so it's a great read.
Chasley is back again with another great children's book.
The next book I want to recommend to you is called Let's Talk About Race by Julius Lester. It's a straightforward book. It says some people think that their race is better than others, and race is part of my story, but it's not all of my story. It's very, very great, very simple, definitely a great book for young children.
I'm here with Jamie right now, and what book did you want to talk about today?
I want to tell you about Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. This book is written actually as a letter by a black man to his son. The letter is written in a super sharp, super flowy, almost poetic narrative, and it really talks about the complexities of the black experience in America. It's a super short book. It's just over 3 hours if you read or listen. I've listened to it a few times, and it's a book that I think every person on this earth should read. That's a bold statement, right? Because of the way it frames both race and racial violence. I can never really explain it in a way that does it justice, and this is why you have to read the book yourself. But the thing that struck me most was the idea that it's the black body, the actual physical body, that's always in danger of being taken or destroyed. And that may seem sort of like an obvious claim, especially today, but the notion and the way he explains it made me realize something that I'd not fully grasped before I read it. And of course, this point is perfectly illustrated by history from the inception of slavery, where physical bodies were taken, to Sandra Bland, again, physically taken, to George Floyd, who was completely destroyed. So I want to read from the book again. I can't explain it in the poetic way that he does. So I'm going to read a piece of the book. And again, this is a letter to his son. So that's kind of how you think of him talking. And you know now, if you did not before, that police departments of your country have been endowed with the authority to destroy your body. It does not matter if the destruction is a result of an unfortunate overreaction. It does not matter if it originates in a misunderstanding. It does not matter if the destruction springs from a foolish policy. Sell cigarettes without the proper authority, and your body can be destroyed. Resent the people trying to entrap your body, and it can be destroyed. Turn into a dark stairwell, and your body can be destroyed. The destroyers will rarely be held accountable. And again, just for perspective, this book was written in 2015. So, you know, even since that time, the list of bodies that have been destroyed is just growing longer and longer. And you know, he kind of reminds you, another way he frames it is that the acts of violence upon Black bodies, they're not, it's not an accident, but it's an intentional architecture of policy and systems that we must create an underclass, if for no other reason, to have an overclass. So equity has never been the goal. He talks a lot about growing up in Baltimore and learning the rules of the streets, while at the same time knowing that there's worlds where children didn't fear for their bodies. He said he'd see it on television. This is a quote from the book. That other world was suburban and endless and organized around pot roast, blueberry pies, fireworks, ice cream sundaes, and immaculate bathrooms. I felt it a cosmic injustice, a profound cruelty, which infused an abiding, irrepressible desire to unshackle my body and achieve the velocity of escape. And then in another part of the book, he talks about a friend of his from Howard University that was shot and killed by police while he was sitting in his Jeep outside of his girlfriend's house. And he talks about the rage that he felt after that murder and how he attended the funeral. And at the funeral, the attendees were praying for strength to forgive the officer who shot the young man. And this next thing really struck me. This is, again, it's a line from the book. The need to forgive the officer would not have moved me, because I knew in some form he was not killed by a single officer, so much as he was murdered by his country and all the fears that have marked it since birth. So especially in light of what's happening around us today, this last thing sort of sums it up to me. You know, of course, there's bad cops and good cops, and no one is disputing that, but the issue is far, far greater. This book made me understand, in a way that really nothing else ever has been able to, the urge to kneel and to shout and to demand a whole new architecture.
And Carrie is joining us to talk about the book called Chokehold. There's a subtitle that neither of us remember exactly what the subtitle is.
It's something like Policing Black Men. So Chokehold is about the way that police and courts and politics and culture all work together to subjugate African Americans and specifically African American men. So the author is Paul Butler, and he's a former federal prosecutor, and he's Black, but he quit after he was falsely accused of a misdemeanor. So he was accused of this crime, and he saw this police officer who just straight up committed perjury on the stand. And it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back after he'd spent years and years being a prosecutor, essentially, I guess he would say, trying crimes almost exclusively against Black men. So one takeaway from this book for me was just how much power police have in this country. So the author tells a story about how in his criminal law class, he's a criminal law teacher now, or professor now. So in his criminal law class, he has a police officer take his students for a ride-along. And during the ride-along, this police officer will play a game that he calls pick a car. He says, pick any car you want and I'll stop it. And then within 5 minutes or three blocks, he can find a legal reason to pull over any single driver. And then he can make them get out of the car, and he can frisk them, and he can even take them to jail, even if it's something like a seatbelt violation. There's not even a crime that's punishable with jail time. You can't even serve jail time for that crime. And so the vast majority of arrests in this country, about 94%, are for nonviolent crimes like that. And so that was one takeaway. But I think even more importantly, the point of the book is kind of that we think of the system as broken, but the author would say is not broken. It's working exactly the way it's designed to. For example, if you go back to arrests, the author says that for misdemeanor arrests, whether or not you're guilty isn't the point. The point is to get Black men in the system and under surveillance. And that's the problem with the idea of like a few bad apples. You know, you hear people say that it's a few bad apples who are racist or who like violating people's rights. But it's not about the individual police officer, and it's not about whether an individual police officer is racist or not. Because you can trace a direct line from slavery through to Jim Crow laws to modern criminal justice and policing. So it's a system that's grown more complex, and it's changed rhetorically somewhat, although you might be surprised how little it's changed rhetorically since like the 1800s. But fundamentally, policing in this country is based in this white supremacist paradigm. And I feel like everybody should read this book. And I think one of the reasons it's so powerful to me is because of the chokehold metaphor. It's such a potent way to describe the system. So if you think about a chokehold, it's like such a terrifying experience. There's terror just like in the heart of it. The terror of your airway being cut off. And it's something where you can't help but struggle. like reflexively. It's just impossible not to struggle because you're dying. And it's a danger that is self-reinforcing also, because the more you struggle, the tighter the chokehold gets and the more urgently you struggle. So to be in the chokehold is to be constantly in mortal danger, and that is the reality of racism in this country.
Did it feel like it had a lot of legal terms and stuff in it, or did it feel pretty accessible?
I felt it was very accessible. Like, even words like misdemeanor, the author will define for the,
oh, that's awesome,
the audience, yeah.
And Sabrina is joining us with a book called Just Mercy.
Yeah, so I read Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson, and it is about Brian's experiences as a death row lawyer, and he helped found the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. And it starts kind of centered on his experiences starting this foundation and this group, and then mainly focuses on Walter McMillan, who is charged with the murder of a local woman which he did not commit. So the cops hid a lot of evidence. They bribed witnesses. They provided false testimony because they needed someone to take the rap for this murder. And Walter had an alibi. He had all these people who knew that, like, he wasn't there, that they were with him. And so it was a really big deal. And no one believed Walter other than the people who knew him. So when Brian, the author, comes into play, he decides that he's going to take the case, he's going to try and figure it out, and he works really diligently and is able to, after 6 years, free Walter. And so it really centers on death row inmates and their experiences and how he works as a lawyer to help them get them off death row. But he also has a lot of other really impactful information about, like, juvenile sentencing and racial history, all the way from, like, slavery through Reconstruction, civil rights movement, and even modern era, which I found really, really interesting. And he goes through the different cases of juvenile offenders and the trauma they've experienced and why they need to be treated with mercy and understanding, and how their brain development isn't, you know, it's immature, it's not all the way there, you know, they still need time to grow and learn, and that they have this great capacity for change and redemption. So I think it's a really important read, because for me, I found myself stopping and reading and Googling and searching so many of the events, the court cases, laws, the rulings, to see how it, like, to find more information, but also to find out where Texas falls, because a lot of it was Alabama focused.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of research on what the Texas side of things were, and it was just fascinating. And if you're looking to really find the background and the information on what has happened as far as laws and juries and courtrooms and things like that, it's really, really great. He talks a lot about mentally ill and trauma-filled lives and what mercy and restorative justice could do for those folks, and how important it is now more than ever that we continue to act with mercy and to look at the whole picture and not just the crime. And I found that to be really impactful to me and to my heart.
What did you learn about Texas?
So I found it really interesting, and there was so much that I probably should have taken better notes. But for example, African Americans weren't allowed to be on the jury, even if their county was predominantly African American. So it wasn't until, I want to say, the late 1980s that it was a requirement for one African American to be on the jury. Like, if that was who was pulled for jury duty and there was at least one, then you had to have at least one on the jury. And so there was really, like, manipulative ways to find some sort of way for certain minorities to not be able to be on the jury. And a lot of that had to do with women too, which was really interesting.
Yeah.
Whether or not they had the quote unquote mental capacity to deal with horrible crimes. So I learned a lot about that, as well as the age, you know, the ages for juvenile offenders and how that works, and how a lot of that just recently changed in the last 30, 40 years, which,
yeah,
is incredible to me that this hasn't happened sooner, or that this wasn't something, or that this was even something that had to be changed. I had no idea that they would try 13 or 14 year olds as adults and then keep them in adult prisons. You know, that in itself is trauma.
Yeah.
So I think what I found really important from this book is that when we get together for these conversations for reform, it's imperative that we have these organizations who have been on the front lines, who have been doing this work, who have been trying to move forward in a way that will help minorities. And if we don't have those people who are already doing the work at the table, then we're doing ourselves a disservice by either reinventing the wheel or not even understanding where the real barriers are for folks. And so I think my biggest takeaway was, as we move forward with reform, that we work towards including all of the people who are out on the front lines doing that work already.
One more fantastic book recommendation from Erlene.
The next book that I wanted to talk about was Why I Am No Longer Talking to White People About Race by Rennie Edu Lodge. What I loved about this one, this started with a blog in 2014, and it hit home for me because it's not that you no longer want to discuss it with white people, it's exhausting. And what I loved about her book and her blog, I read the blog, I went back and read the blog after I read the book, it's a collection of different writings and essays, and it's about structural racism, class, feminism, and white privilege, basically. And one of her quotes was, in the absence of consequences, is an absence of consequences in racism. No one wants to acknowledge racism or take fault for it because the constant thing is, that wasn't me, I wasn't a part of that, I didn't do this. She hits home with the breakdown of British Black history, because she's from Britain, and how Blacks in Britain have very similar struggles as African Americans that no one really wants to acknowledge. People tend to think that it's only here when it's totally worldwide. She talks more about how, just like many of us here in the United States, she learned about her Blackness and her history when she went to university. And I can agree with that. When you're in school, you learn about American history, and it's always like a paragraph or a chapter for minorities in some way, either being American Indians, Hispanics, or African Americans, and everything else is very white. But when you go to university or college, you're able to actually take African-American studies, you're able to take these classes. And I really recommend this book because it breaks down not only American racism, but it goes into what happens in Britain and England and what she experienced.
And we are here with our lovely co-host to talk about So You Want to Talk About Race.
So You Want to Talk About Race is by Ijeoma Olugo. And she wrote the book because she realized that she was having the same conversations over and over again with different people about specific topics. So rather than keep repeating herself over and over again, although she does a number of speeches and she's made a lot of television appearances, she wanted to put together a really nice topical guide to very specific subjects and how they tie into race. Some of these subjects include things like the school-to-prison pipeline, affirmative action, intersectionality, which was an amazing chapter, or even things like my favorite chapter, I Just Got Called a Racist, What Do I Do Now? The point of that chapter is that so many people, when they are called a racist, immediately act defensive, if not outright indignant. When really, if someone says that to you, it's your chance to pause and really delve into some much needed self-reflection. I love the way she ended the chapter. She said, "Fear the thought that right now, you could be contributing to the oppression of others, and you don't know it. But do not fear those who bring that oppression to light. Do not fear the opportunity to do better." And that's really what this book is about. It's about giving people at least a very high-level knowledge of some of these important topics so that we can talk about race in a way that is productive and inflicts as little harm on others as possible. Her writing style is very conversational. It makes it easy to read, even though she is delving into tough topics. She also adds a number of very personal anecdotes that make it so easy to understand and relate to what she is trying to explain. Early on in the book, she describes a conversation that she had with her mother, who happened to make a slightly inappropriate joke at work, and then ended up calling Ijeoma to talk to her about it afterward because she had had this epiphany. For the record, Ijeoma's mother is white, so there were a number of things that she didn't necessarily get. Ijeoma actually put off the conversation for a while because she dreaded it, and it was exactly as emotional and awkward and exhausting as anyone could expect. At the end of it, her mother was able to finally reach a real epiphany and shift her focus from trying to prove that she was woke to pressuring white people to do better. And that's really what all of this is about. These conversations are difficult, and as Ijeoma points out, we are going to screw them up, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have them, as long as we're doing everything in our power to make sure that we minimize the hurt we inflict on others. She says it best, so I'm going to end with a quote. "If you are white and you don't want to feel any of that pain by having these conversations, then you are asking people of color to bear the entire burden of racism alone."
I would say that, like I said before, when you look into these books and read these books, it can be very uncomfortable. But as in, I no longer want to talk to white people about race, Like she points out, when I'm speaking to people about race that do not look like me, you can already see in their mind they're thinking defensively because they're thinking of how do I respond to tell you that you're wrong. And after a while, that gets exhausting discussing race relations with anyone. So it's really a great idea to take these readings and just calm down and just look at it from a different point of view, not to respond, but more so just to kind of acknowledge what we're saying.
And that's it.
Wow, that was a lot of information.
But if you still want more, there is much more that you can do to educate yourself or even to act. TED Talks has a wonderful playlist to help you understand racism if you want to delve into that even further. You can act. You can follow or join different organizations such as the Bail Project or the Color of Change if you're wanting to put your money where your heart is. They're also, like, one of the best things that you can do is to support Black businesses. And it just so happens that July 10th through 19th is the moved date for Black Restaurants Week. So if you want to check out some really good restaurants in Houston, that would be the time to look at some of their special menus that they have just for that week.
Especially because it's been such a hard time for small businesses.
Yes. In fact, the dates were originally going to be in April, but that had to get moved because of COVID.
Yes, that makes sense. The most important thing you can do is, like my wonderful co-host Leslie says, to make sure that you're making a space for Black creators and voices and restaurateurs. And it's easy because all you have to do is enjoy the wonderful products that they're giving you.
Right.
It's the easiest way to make sure that in our capitalist society, we're giving people spaces by telling the companies that we want to hear them and we want to have the things that they're making.
So thank you so much for joining us. And stay tuned next week for more fantastic book recommendations.
Bye!